The Guardian.
Support for this podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand, or portfolio so easy, it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello and welcome back to Science Weekly with me, Ian Sample. On the show this week, what does it feel like to win the Nobel Prize? And how do we find our way in the world? We meet the newly announced winners of the 2014 Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine. And we'll look at the winners from the Physics and Chemistry Prizes too. Also on the show, we have the week's top science stories, including fresh analysis of early cave paintings in Indonesia. And could the fantasy of removing or altering what a human brain remembers become a reality? This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. I'm delighted to say we're joined by all three winners of this year's Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine. Down the line from Norway are Maybrit and Edvard Moser from the Norwegian University of Science and Technology in Trondheim. And in the studio, we have John O'Keefe from University College London. Also joining us is Nicola Davis of Observer Tech Monthly. Nobel Prize winners, congratulations to all of you, first of all.
Thank you so much.
And congratulations, John.
Thank you, my Brit, and congratulations to yourself and Edvard.
Hugs through the phone.
We'll get later to how you all come to know each other, because this is a lovely story. But first of all, and I don't want to spend too much time on some of this sort of fluffy stuff, but do take us through briefly how you got the news. And I'd like to start with John and then my Brit and Edvard, because Edvard, I think you were the most elusive. John, how did you get the news?
I quite often spend mornings at home at my desk trying to get as much work done as I can before I go into work and into the laboratory. So I was actually still at home and therefore out of contact, because that's one of the reasons to stay at home, with the outside world. So I was sitting there and one of my colleagues called up and said, there's a chap here. He says he's from Stockholm, and he'd like to talk to you urgently. So would you like to call? So, of course, I sat down, took a very long, deep breath, and called up the secretary of the Nobel Committee. And I actually knew that who the secretary was. I had met him previously. So, yes, that was quite an interesting period.
My Brit, tell us about your experience.
Yeah, so my experience was that we had a normal lab meeting and we had a really exciting discussion about some new results that a PhD student presented. So the meeting lasted longer than it should, and I had another meeting just after. And then there was a phone call, and I didn't recognize the number. And then I was thinking, I can't answer this phone. But then I thought, maybe one day I should behave. And then I took the phone, and then he said, "Hello, this is Jørgen Hansen." I thought, "What? Why do you call me?" And then I thought, maybe I should go to my office. I was running. And sat down, and then he said, "You won the Nobel Prize with John and Edvard." And I was, "What? I don't believe you!" And then I started to cry, and I all the happiness. And then I was thinking about all the people who had helped us. So I was just, "No, I don't believe it. Can you please send it on an email? Because I don't believe you."
Edvard, I was trying to get hold of you and John and my Brit that day, most of that day. And when I called the Norwegian University of Science and Technology, they said, "Look, we're doing our best. Edvard is in the air. He's on his way. he's on a plane on the way to Munich. We're trying to get hold of the airline so they can get the pilot to make the announcement." How did that story end?
No, so I didn't know anything. I came out of the plane, and then as I came out of the gate, I saw there was a woman standing there with a name sign, my name, and with flowers, and with one of these airport cars to drive me through. And I didn't understand anything because I thought I could walk myself. And then I asked why, and she said, "You won a prize." And then I said, "What? What prize?" And then she said, "A prize from the Max Planck Society." So she had mixed up because I was going to Max Planck Society. So then I was writing, didn't know more, and started checking my phone. And then I saw there was a message, urgent, from Göran Hansen, who is the secretary of the Nobel Committee, called me back immediately. And then I started wondering too. And then a few seconds afterwards, then my host in Germany, Tobias Bonhoeffer, called me and congratulated. So that was the way I found out. And then I called back to Göran later, but it took a while before I really realized it was surrealistic.
One of the winners of the Chemistry Prize had an interesting reaction when he was talking to the Nobel Foundation in the interview they recorded. He said that after saying, yes, I was very shocked and so on, he said, I felt half happiness and half fear. And the person calling from Stockholm said, where does the fear come from? This was Erik Betsig. And he said, I like my life as it is. And I'm going to have to learn to say no. And he had clearly immediately realized what was going to happen. And I wondered if among the three of you, any of you share this sense of fear that for all the obvious, wonderful positives, your lives aren't going to be the same again.
Yes, I have to say, I certainly share that. I wouldn't call it quite fear. I'd call it apprehension. And certainly, like Erik Betsig, I like the life I lead now, and I hope that I will be able to continue to do most of what I do now. I like being in the laboratory, doing experiments. I like all of the other things I do. So I'm going to try very hard. I'm quite happy to have a week or two as someone who talks about our research to the media and things like that. And I do feel that the scientists in our position have to speak out on some issues that are of importance to scientists. But I don't see myself as becoming a media guru. I don't know. I'll leave that to my Brit and Ed Edvard.
I think we just have to learn to be even more careful about selecting what we accept. That's the trick, because we all want to continue to do science.
Yes.
Yeah, that's our passion.
My Brit, you're only the 11th woman to win the Medicine Prize since 1901. Given the time, like, yeah, given the.
Oh.
Time lag between the discoveries and the prizes. I think much of that reflects the state of medical science in the early 20th century. But I just wondered, how is it now? Is do you see that imbalance still in the community, or
no? So I've always been a boy girl tomboy, but I start to realize how important it is for other women to see a woman receiving prizes and doing well. So now I'm more careful, and I try to be a good model for these women, because it's so important. We need also female researchers that are excellent.
Also, together as a married couple, you and Edvard are the fifth couple to win a Nobel Prize. I don't want to dwell on that. You've spoken about it a lot already, but I was interested that you got engaged on Mount Kilimanjaro, a dormant volcano.
You like that.
And you have this shared interest in volcanoes. The only question I'll ask you about marriage in science: what is it about volcanoes?
I think it's exciting. I mean, I like to do other things than just neuroscience too. I like many sciences, and geology is interesting, but it's also nice to be in the mountains, and there's always some excitement being on an active volcano. You never know if it's going well.
If you survive or not.
All three of you had huge reputations in neuroscience before winning this prize. No, there's no doubt of that, but surely once, you hold the title of Nobel Prize winner, you get presumably these offers flood in from the world's institutions trying to tempt you over to set up a lab where they are. Is that something you see coming? How do you deal with that?
Well, we have dealt with it for quite a while, because people have wanted us to move to other places, because Trondheim is a really remote place in the world. But we feel we are at the best place, for us at least. So we have very good support, very good funding, and lots of space, and a very creative and happy environment. So no need to leave.
Our team is just excellent, so we are extremely happy here.
John, you've just set up a huge team in London.
Well, I am in the process. I was going to say that I see it from the other side. I'm trying to tempt people to leave their institutions and come to London. One never says no, but I really love London. I think it's a great place to live and a great place to do science. So we are now setting up this institute, the Sainsbury Wellcome Centre, and we've put out an advertisement and are trying to attract some of the best people in the world to come here. So I see the other way around.
We take them first, John.
Yes, we're in competition.
We always compete.
The three of you won the prize for the discovery of cells that constitute a positioning system in the brain. And the media's obviously done all its thing on that and in all sorts of poor and better ways. But it's about how we navigate our environment. And I wondered, is it a coincidence that, John, you spend your weekends walking around southern England, Edvard, you're into hiking, and Maybrit, you go running all the time. But you seem to be, there seems to be a common thread here that you're into this sort of spatial awareness. Maybe that's, I don't know if that's anything to connect it with your work.
Actually, one thing we did when John has visited us many times. So one thing we did.
He promised not to tell Edvard.
We did an experiment together. So we went up in a remote mountain area. It was very, very flat, just forest, small forest, and everything looked the same everywhere. And then the three of us walked around, and we actually managed to get lost. Just to feel how it was.
We asked John beforehand, because we said, if we go this path, we know that we're going to get lost. Do you want to be lost with us? And he, if you don't tell.
So what did you learn from this experiment?
That even the best navigators sometimes are lost.
You need landmarks to reset your map all the time. Isn't that what you taught us?
Yes, that's exactly the conclusion I think one should draw. But going back to your question, Ian, I have to say that the discovery, at least of the place cells, and perhaps not of the grid cells, but the place cells, predated my interest in navigation and even in walking. So if anything, it's the other way around. When we started to work on exactly what these cells might be doing, and particularly the idea that they would provide a map which would provide the basis for navigation, then I started looking at things like the ordnance survey maps and read the literature on navigation and homing and started thinking about it. And if anything, it was the causation was in that direction. I started becoming very interested and then took up walking in the late 70s, early 80s.
So let's break this down a little bit. Between you discovered so-called place cells, which you've just been talking about, John, and grid cells and other types of cells too. John, can you just take us through how place cells work?
How they work is that if you listen in on the activity or watch the activity of one of these cells, what you find is that they're interested primarily, not necessarily exclusively, but primarily in where the activity is taking place, where the animal or we think the human is actually doing the activity. They respond, for example, when an animal goes over to one part of an environment, but not when it goes to another part of the environment. It can do the same activity in both places, and it will only respond in one area. So they seem to be responding to or interested in where the activity takes place and not what is actually being done.
John, what is making the cells fire?
So that was an important question right from the beginning. And if you think about it, it's clear that you can locate yourself in any environment in one of two ways. The most obvious way is you can look around and see where the landmarks are, where the window is, where the door to the room is. And by a simple method of triangulation, you can figure out where you are on the basis of that. But it dawned on us that it was also possible to locate yourself in another very different way. And that is, once you knew you were in one place, you could calculate how far and in a particular direction you had moved since that location and, as it were, update your map representation so that you could now predict and locate yourself in the new location. In that way, you would have two independent inputs into the system, one based on the actual information that you had available at the time, and the other a predictive system which would say what you should expect when you were there. And you could imagine that you put these two types of information together and see if they match.
Nicola?
I was wondering, the information that's going in that's being used to sort of create this sort of map inside. Is it from the visual sort of cues? Is it audio? Like, what happens if you have one of your stimulus knocked out? How does that affect?
So that's a very good question. And it turns out that you can use any of the available information. But it's surprising to us, even in an animal such as a rat or a mouse, which aren't as visual as we are, the primary source of information tends to be the visual input. So vision is very, very strong, and you can see why it would be, because visual landmarks are very, very dominant, and they give you a very, very strong spatial sense of spatial input.
And what in the brain responds to that activity from the place cells, John?
Well, it can be used for several purposes. It can be used to locate oneself in a particular place.
Is that within the hippocampus, though?
Yes,
because these cells are in the hippocampus.
Yeah. So you could it says where you are, and it will also, by combining that information with information from other areas of the brain, say whether this is a good place or a bad place or a neutral place, or whether this is a place you know and are familiar with, or a place you've been in before, or a place you don't know, and in which case you should actually act in a way, explore, to find out more about that location. But they can also be used to actually provide the information about how you get to other places. So they can be used for navigation. And they can do that in a very interesting way. They can do it in a way which enables the person or the animal to be very flexible in navigating. So let's say I want to go to the door over there, and I know how I want to go. It's easy. I just walk straight to the door. But if all of a sudden there's a big table in front of me, I can then say, oh, the system will enable me to calculate how to take another path. So it gives you a very flexible, powerful system for navigating in known environments.
So if these cells work in humans the way you found they work in rats, if I'm on my morning bike commute to work from South London to North London, what is happening with these cells in my hippocampus? Would you expect some place cells to be firing when I hit a particular junction I know well, and a different group of place cells to be firing when I hit another sort of feature of my journey that I know very well, for example? How does that activity change as I go through my route?
Well, you've asked a very, very important question, which I'll turn over to the Mosers to answer in a second. But if we're talking about smaller scale environments, then what we see is that there is a continuous mapping. So as the animal moves around the environment, one group of cells hands over to the next group of cells, so that there's a continuous representation of the environment wherever you are in the environment. If you think about it, that begins to be a little bit problematic in your case if you go from one part of London to another. So we're still a little bit unclear about how that works. I say I'll hand over to the Mosers because they have, in fact, started to address that problem. They have done experiments in very, very large environments, and they're coming up with some part of the answer. And there's another group, a group in Israel, which are now beginning to look at bats, and they have animals which are flying over very large distances. So we're beginning to get some idea of the answer to that.
So, Maybrit and Edvard, we'll come to grid cells in a bit, but John thought you may be able to add something on this.
Yeah, I mean, what we have done in our lab is to extend the size of the environments a little bit. So, I mean, most of the work in this field has been in rats that have been walking in boxes that maybe 1 meter wide and no more. So we took our lab. It was at that time only 18 meters long, but then we made a track that was 18 meters long, and then recorded activity from place cells on that, and then we found that as you go deeper into the brain, further down into the bottom of the brain, but still in the hippocampus, you actually see that the scale of these place cells, place fields, increases, and you get fields that are no longer maybe just half a meter wide, but they can be 5, 6, 7 meters long. So it's really, you have multiple scales, and they're sort of organized from the top to the bottom of the brain. But I would also say, like John, that what we really don't know anything is, if you now go out in the natural environments, which are much more complex and of course much, much bigger, this will for sure work locally, I think, but how is it all connected together over very large distances? That's still a remaining question.
Oh, but we know that the map is reset by the geometry, for example. So if the animal is walking in parallel corridors, we know that it's reset at every start of one corridor.
So you may have multiple maps that then are stitched together somehow in a way we don't really understand.
Mm. Nicola, you had a question.
Well, I just wanted to go back a little bit here. How do we actually monitor and detect the activity of those cells? Because this, you know, these are not, you know, often one thinks about when you look at samples, particularly a lot of people, most people's experience of looking at cells is going to be some dead cell on a slide. People don't necessarily have the experience of dealing with, you know, cells that are being activated in a live animal as it's wandering around. How do you actually look at those cells and what's happening and what's firing and so on?
So what we learned from John is to listen to the cells. What we do is to have these small sensors located close to the cells, and then we can listen to the small electrical signals, because we can amplify that, say, 10,000 times, 20,000 times. And then it's like this, pop, 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 pop. And when the animal is going into John's place field, for example, then it's mostly silent. But then when it's starting to move into this field, then it's pop, 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 pop. And it's so exciting. And I just remember when we shared this excitement with John, because he was so much in the lab, and then just listening to this beautiful music of these small electrical signals that we can record from these cells.
And what kind of resolution can you get down to? Like, how many cells are you looking at any one?
Yeah, so again, the technology that was developed in John's lab, also together with Bruce McNaughton and Carol Barnes and so on, they decided to not only using one electrode or two electrodes, but also four electrodes that were twisted so that they were so close, so that these four electrodes could listen to many cells at the same time, but one electrode would be closer to one cell than the other electrode, and then you can correlate activity among two and two of these electrodes, and then you have a cloud of such spikes on a screen, and then you can give a number to these cells and put different colors. John, you can probably describe this better because you developed it.
So yes, my Brit is right. We realized that was one of the big problems. And since we're sitting outside of the cells, there are normal, healthy cells as far as we can tell, and the animal is going about its daily business, that there are difficulties with resolution of the technique. And it was particularly Bruce McNaughton's idea, came up with a way of solving that by using a triangulation process where we used not one sensor, but several sensors. We're still limited in the number with that technique of cells that we can look at the same time. And since we believe that it's the combination of activity across large numbers of cells which is providing the information, many people have been looking forward to the present era where we now think we will be able to record from not only hundreds but thousands of cells at the same time. So we now
and now we can even see them, John.
And we can see them. We can use either
with a microscope.
We use electrical or now the new optical techniques. So we're looking forward to a new era in which we will be able to see much more of the representation and begin, we think, to be able to see how the cells talk to each other and create these concepts and memories that we're all interested in.
I'm interested in how your work overlaps with memory and longer term memory, because we all have places in our past where we can go back there and find ourselves around reasonably well. I can go back to my home village in Oxford and find the stream I used to play in. I can go to Bristol, I can go to Manchester, you know, go to Manhattan and find my way around and so on. Are there areas in my hippocampus, are there place cells that themselves retain a memory of a layout of a place, or is that memory banked somewhere else, or how does this work?
That's a bit controversial, if I could answer first, and maybe we might get into a little argument on the air. It's a bit controversial. In general, our impression from the early studies and up until the recent studies suggested that if a cell is interested in a particular location, if it has a preferred place in a familiar environment, then you can come back day after day and the cell will continue to fire in the same place. And we think that is a form of memory. More recently, using some of these new techniques where people have been able to monitor not one or a few cells, but many, many cells over longer periods of time, what we're beginning to see is that while many of the cells continue to identify the same place, other cells tend to be a little less sure about it and come in and come out, and there's a bit of uncertainty. And it's almost as though you could use that uncertainty to say how long it has been since you had the first experience in that place. We're not sure about that, but there's some interest in that idea.
Edvard and Maybrit, what do you make of that?
Well, as John said, I mean, there has been some controversy, but I still think that now most people believe that space is the fundamental property that's encoded by these place cells, but then that on top of that, these cells also may encode other properties of the environment, which probably include parts of our experiences in that space, so that it's a kind of combined code, but that space is a kind of skeleton on top of which you encode everything else. And I think we all experience that ourselves too, when we just recall some episode, something you experienced yesterday, you almost can't do that without also recalling the location, because they are so closely tied together. And that is probably what happens in the place cells.
So the place cells themselves are probably constituting some element of the memory, at least.
Yes.
Yeah, you can just think about odors, for example. You can be sent back to any space in time just by seeing or to smell something, and then you're just sent back. So there was one experiment at York University, the Viking Museum, and the Vikings smelled really badly. People who had been there just once, and then the experimenter met them 20 years after and exposed them to one of these bad Viking odors, they said immediately, oh, this is from York, the Viking Museum. So we are sent back in time to a certain place by our memories.
Having been to that museum, I can definitely attest to that.
Oh, I haven't. I'm just, maybe I am from a Viking relative, so I have Viking family far.
Maybrit and Eva, would you take us through how grid cells fit into this? These are not in the hippocampus. They're in the neighbouring entorhinal cortex. Is that right?
Yes. So these cells are somewhat similar to the place cells that John discovered, in that they fire only in certain locations in the environment. But the difference is that, first of all, they fire in many, many places, and then in between the cells are completely silent. And then for each cell, those active places, they form a kind of very, very regular pattern. And that pattern is triangular or hexagonal, if you want. So it forms a matrix that covers the entire space over which the animal, or presumably the human, is walking around. So we quite often compare it to a kind of coordinate system, because it is so regular and it provides information about both distances and directions.
So I need to understand this a little bit more. Is it as if there is a sort of a virtual, a sort of invisible hexagonal pattern on the floor, presumably only in two dimensions, but maybe we shouldn't go into that, that you get activity as I would move from one of these imagined hexagons to another?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so if you imagine you walk in a box that is, let's say, 2 meters by 2 meters, and you cover every single possible place in that box. Afterwards, you ask, where are the locations where that particular cell, this particular grid cell, actually was active or fired? Then you will see that those locations, they form these very, very regular patterns, almost like the cross points of a graphics paper. It's just that it's not a quadratic unit, but it's a triangle. So it's a kind of...
like Chinese chessboard.
Yeah, like a Chinese checkerboard.
And do they talk to the place cells, or do they both, the place cells and the grid cells, talk to something in common in the hippocampus, or what?
Yeah, they're very, very closely related. So most likely many of them contact each directly, because the grid cells, they are not the only types of cells in the entorhinal cortex that project into the hippocampus, but it's a major part, so it's very, very unlikely that they don't contact the place cells. And then the other way around too, probably, that the place cells at least indirectly feed back again to the grid cells. So they form a quite interconnected system.
And there are also the different resolution of these cells. So you have cells with small fields, with small distance between the fields, and then you have bigger. And if you align them on top of each other, then you get one field like you see in the hippocampus as the place cell. Then we, at least one way of thinking is that the grid pattern is anchored to the environment by the memory that it receives from the place cells from the hippocampus. But then the grid cells give information to the hippocampus, creating a place field. That's speculation, it's not proved, but I love that model.
I think we all love that model, my friend.
There are other cells in the brain apart from these place and grid cells that help with navigating the environment, though. I think they're involved in direction. So just give me some ideas of what other cells are doing what. I mean, just very briefly.
Shall I start on that? So if you want to find your way around the world and use this internal navigation system that I described earlier, you need to know not only how far you're going, which we think the grid cells will provide, but you also need to know the direction in which you're moving. And around 1984, a man called Jim Ronk, working in New York City, discovered that class of cell, and he called them head direction cells. And these are cells, each one has a preferred heading direction. So if the rat looks in, let's call it north, although we think it's probably not responding to geomagnetism in rodents, but might be in other animals. If the animal looks north, then one cell will fire, but the others will be quiet. But then if you look at another of these cells, it might respond when the animal looks east. And if you look at enough of them, you see that they actually completely cover the whole of the compass directions. So essentially, this is the brain's internal compass. You can see how you start to build up this idea that there are lots of different spatial cell types, and that when you put them all together, then you probably will come up with something which we call a cognitive map, a cognitive mapping system.
Most of the work you do, all three of you, is in rats, of course. And I wondered if there's anything you can do to get a handle on this in humans, whether this is working the same way. And I was thinking, are there people you can study with, I don't know, lesions in the hippocampus or the entorhinal cortex? Can you use any non-invasive technology to try and get any idea of how these systems might be working in people?
So, John, yes. Isn't that what happened to you when you put your sensors into the rat brain for the first time? You
yes.
went for the hippocampus because you learned about HM.
Yes. So this whole field really started off, and interest in the hippocampus started off with work by Brenda Milner in Montreal, who studied a patient who had the initials of HM until he unfortunately died recently, and his name is Henry Mollison. And that patient had epilepsy and had rather extensive removal surgery which resulted in extensive removal of tissue in the hippocampal region of the brain. And when he came around, the epilepsy had been ameliorated, so he had fewer fits, but he had a profound memory deficit. So even as early as the 1950s, we knew that the hippocampus was some sort of a memory system. And it turns out to be the type of memory system that Mybritt and Edvard have mentioned, an episodic memory system. So in humans, it's widely believed, and we also believe, that it's a system for remembering what you did in a particular place at a particular time. So over the years, people have always asked, well, what's the difference between the hippocampus in a rat and hippocampus in humans? And it was probably only in the middle of the 1990s that my colleagues and I, Eleanor Maguire and Neil Burgess, realized that we could use virtual reality techniques to test this in humans. Up until then, most of the spatial tasks and spatial memory tasks that people had used were, where are things on a tabletop? So you would ask somebody to remember that one object is one place and another object was in another place. But when virtual reality became available, and I should add, cheap enough for scientists to use it in the 1990s, we realized you could use these first-person shoot-em-up games. They're called Doom and Duke Nukem and things like that. So Neil Burgess, who is an extremely talented, has a PhD in mathematical physics, spent several months taking these games apart in our laboratory. And you can imagine what all these neuroscientists and anatomists were thinking when they passed by and here we were all playing these.
Another day in the office.
And what Neil did, what he took the games apart and actually removed all of the politically incorrect features, like the monsters and the guns and all those sorts of things. So we were left with a beautiful test platform, which would enable us to study navigation in large-scale environments, say 7 to 80 meters in humans. So the first thing we did, of course, then was ask the question, can we see what parts of the brain light up in humans as they navigate in this large environment? And what we found, to our great delight, is that the hippocampus was one of only two parts of the brain which was activated. And we then looked at patients who had damage in these areas and found that they were also very, very poor at finding their way around in these large-scale scale environments. And it also turns out that colleagues of mine now, including Neil Burgess and Dennis Chan, who's at Cambridge now, are using this to try to develop tasks for the earliest diagnosis of the Alzheimer's disease. It turns out that one of the earliest signs of Alzheimer's disease is getting lost. And it turns out that one of the earliest places in the brain which is attacked by the disease is the entorhinal cortex and the hippocampal formation more generally. So we think this basic research is actually going to enable us to begin to develop techniques for diagnosing and studying some of the earlier processes in Alzheimer's disease as well.
Where do you all think this work is going? Do you think it might start helping neuroscientists to understand other brain processes? Like, is it going to shed light on how brain activity influences other behaviors or more abstract things like imagination and so on?
I think the nice thing about the spatial system is that this is in a way in the middle of the brain. It's really far away from the sensory receptors and from the motor neurons, so that we can really study what are the internal computations of the brain. And both the place cells and the grid cells are examples of patterns that the brain has made up entirely on its own. For example, there's nothing like a hexagonal pattern out in the world. It's something that is created by the brain. So I believe that by studying that, we can actually get on the track of some of the fundamental computations that take place in the brain. And because the brain is, or biology in general, is conservative, it uses the same solutions over and over again in different ways, then I think this is can put us on the track of actually understanding other brain complex cognitive brain processes too.
Yes, I agree with that. And it's been recognized, certainly anatomically, for many, many years, that hippocampus is a kind of simple, or I wouldn't say primitive, cortex, but it certainly is a simple cortex. And it's reasonable to expect that things that we learn there will actually apply, at least partially, to more general neocortex, the parts of the brain which I think we now believe create the visual objects that we see and much of the conscious world that we experience. And that's proving, for example, one possible way that might work is that, as I said earlier, we know that the hippocampal pyramidal cells receive inputs from both the outside world, but also from some predictive internal bodily signals. And this idea now that you have two inputs, one from the external world and one from an internal predictive system, are beginning to show up now in the neocortex. So in the visual cortex, it's beginning to look as though you not only can activate these cells from inputs coming in from the visual world, but from top-down signals from deeper in the brain, which say you should now be expecting to see the following things. So that general model might actually apply to much of neocortex in general.
John, I didn't want to let you go without just touching on a couple of points you've raised since winning the prize about some of your concerns over science in Britain. And you mentioned specifically restrictions over immigration, but also some concerns around animal research. I just wonder if you had anything more to sort of say on those issues.
You know, as a scientist, one has to keep in touch with things in the more general world. And I think that several of the things you mentioned are things which are important for scientists to keep track of. And of course, it's now important that we sort of talk about these things. So I am, yes, it's one of the things that I think one has to do now as someone who is more visible in the public eye is to be concerned about those issues.
But do you think, what are the specifics? I mean, with animal research, are you worried that there will be restrictions come in that make this work just very hard to do.
I think Britain has always been in the forefront of keeping a close eye on animal work, and it was one of the things that I found very attractive when I came here early on. There is a whole system in place for monitoring and controlling animal experiments. It works very well, to my mind. It's always being revisited. There is a commitment on the part of the government and scientists to try to be very careful about the use of animals, and I think we all are. There is always a danger with systems like that, that they might actually become overly bureaucratic. And of course, that depends to some extent on how much funding goes into them so that there are enough, for example, inspectors who look around. So one worries that that could happen. It hasn't happened yet, but one keeps an eye on it.
You've also had some issues to raise about just getting scientists into the country around barriers to immigration.
Yes, it's again, Britain has had a long history of being very welcoming to foreigners. As I've pointed out, I'm an immigrant myself, and I found it was terrific to come here, and I like the idea that Britain is a very heterogeneous, welcoming society. We have very culturally diverse. My real concerns are not about bringing in people who are already well-established scientists. I think it's there are roots for that, and I think that's very well handled. I think it's more the perception that students in other countries might get, that Britain is less interested in having them come here and study here. And quite often people who come here then become scientists and decide to stay here. So it is a danger that we might, by restricting students, we might be limiting our future pool of scientists.
We have coverage of the other Nobel Prizes on the Guardian website. That's theguardian.com/science. The winner of the Physics Prize were Shuji Nakamura at the University of California, Santa Barbara. And he shared the prize with Osamu Akasaki of Maijo and Nagoya Universities and Hiroshio Amano of Nagoya University as well. They won the Physics Prize for developing blue LEDs, which has allowed white lighting, energy-efficient white lighting around the world. The Chemistry Prize went to Eric Betzig and William Murner in the US and Stefan Hell in Germany for developing super-resolution optical microscopy.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the simple yet powerful website-building platform. As a Guardian podcast listener, it goes without saying that you're a clever clogs. The good news is that building your own professional website with Squarespace is easy. Whether the site you need is for a small business, online store, professional portfolio, or blog, getting started takes seconds. Go to squarespace.com today and show support for this podcast and get 10% off. Use the offer code Guardian.
Sticking with the theme of the brain, Hollywood has repeatedly explored the fantasy of removing or altering what a human brain remembers. Now researchers are using drugs to suppress the emotional impact of traumatic memories. They've been able to implant false memories in flies and mice so that innocuous environments or smells seem to be remembered as more threatening. They're showing that our memories are constantly being changed and updated and can be falsified with alarming ease. The brain seems to elaborate and fill in gaps, meaning we can't easily distinguish truth from invention. Just telling someone they experienced something they didn't, or showing them digitally manipulated photos, can be enough to seed a false conviction. Nicola, tell us a bit more about this work.
Well, this is from an article that was in Observer Tech Monthly that came out yesterday. It's written by the wonderful Philip Ball. And it's basically sort of looking at just how much of a detachment from reality actually are films like, you know, Blade Runner, Eternal Sunshine of a Spotless Mind, those kind of films. You know, are they complete flights of fancy, or is there some nugget of truth in them? And it sort of looks at some interesting work. I mean, you talked there about the idea of suppressing the emotional impact of traumatic memories. And one of the things that Philip talks about is the use of a drug called propranolol. What it does is that it doesn't delete the memory, but what it does do is it reduces the sort of emotional recall that you have with it, so that you can sort of think about the events without recalling the emotion or turmoil of it, which sort of gives people a sense of detachment. And they've also found that the gas xenon can also do this. So they're thinking of using this in things like soldiers with post-traumatic stress disorder, and also the sort of situations, for example, rape, where, again, you need to be able to detach that terrible emotion from the event itself.
And so you recall the memory, and then it becomes perhaps more malleable, or some aspect of it that it is linked to becomes able to be interfered with in some way. Is that right?
Well, in this particular case, they're sort of looking at being able to just look at the facts without having some kind of huge emotional kick. You know, they say that sort of the patients are saying things like, you know, I'm no longer personally gripped by the memory anymore. So you can see why that would be a very valuable tool. The piece also looks at whether it's possible to sort of falsely implant a connection or a memory into an organism. So they've been looking at mice and putting mice into a chamber, giving it sort of a mild electric shock through its feet. And then they're able to manipulate the memory such that when they put it into a chamber it's never been in before, they can kind of trigger the memory to create an association with those electric shocks so that the mouse becomes afraid of that environment, even though it wasn't that environment it experienced the electric shocks in. So it's this kind of like twisting the memory. It's a very kind of sinister sounding idea, actually.
John, memories are not these discrete sort of packets of neural activity sort of tucked away like a Rolodex, like a filing cabinet in the brain. They're sort of these more distributed entities. Is that right?
Yes, they are. And one of the things you should be aware of is that different memories are located in different parts of the brain. So, for example, if you had a memory of an emotional event, that would involve the hippocampus, but it would also involve other areas of the brain, perhaps, for example, the amygdala, another part of the temporal lobes. And the traumatic part of the memory, the idea that an event was a negative one, had a negative affect, would come partly from the amygdala. So what this research is doing is trying to use that fact to be able to activate memories. And it's known that if you activate a memory, that makes it more labile, as you were suggesting earlier. It puts it into a state where it can be modified. Much of the same machinery is activated as is activated in the original process. So that then gives you the opportunity of actually interfering and trying to manipulate. In this case, I think it could potentially be used to actually manipulate the affective part of the memory, the emotional part of the memory, and change that while keeping the other parts of the memory intact.
It's always ridiculous to start a sentence, "Do you think we'll ever be able to?" But do you think it will be possible to implant a complex memory into people's brains at some point, or even understand a piece together a complex memory in someone's brain?
I don't know. To some extent, it depends on whether we find out enough about memories to know how to do that. I mean, since memories are in many parts of the brain distributed across large numbers of neurons, at present it seems to be an unrealistic possibility. But I don't think one would want to rule it out. I guess the real question is why you would want to do something like that. And of course, as with everything else in science, we have to have the question about which aspects of science we want to use and implement and which we have to not. So I think the example I gave you where you might want to erase the negative emotional parts of memories, we can all understand why you might want to do that. I'm not sure we would understand why you would want to do this other thing.
You can read more about this in the latest edition of Observer Tech Monthly.
Also in the news this week, it's been an interesting story about some early artwork. Ian, you've been writing about this. So paintings of wild animals and hand markings left by adults and children on cave walls in Indonesia are at least 35,000 years old, making them some of the oldest artworks known. The rock art was originally discovered in the 1950s, but scientists dismissed them as less than 10,000 years old because they didn't believe older works could survive the erosion in the tropical climate. Now that's been overturned. A fresh analysis has dated one hand marking to at least 39,900 years old. Ian, why is this so significant?
Well, what I love about this story is that these are caves and shelters that sit at the bottom of these huge limestone towers that rise up out of rice fields in southwestern Sulawesi in Indonesia, so the largest island in Indonesia. They actually appear in a book by Alfred Russel Wallace when he was out there for a few months collecting butterflies, and he commented on how staggering and amazing these caves and shelters were, but he didn't notice the rock art in them. That was discovered in the 50s. But people thought because the environment was so tropical that no art would last very long. And so they dismissed it. No one had actually properly dated it. So this team from Wollongong and some Indonesian researchers went in there. And what they did is they looked at a uranium-thorium ratio, a geological clock you can use, of what they call cave popcorn, which are these kinds of limestone, calcium carbonate, I think, clusters that as the water trickles down the walls, they form on the rock face. And obviously you get some forming underneath the art that was there before the art was done, and you get some forming over the art. So looking at those two and dating them, you can get different time margins on when this art was made. And they expected this to be pretty young. It turned out that these wonderful depictions, very delicate depictions of some of the interesting and unique animals you had on Sulawesi. They call it the Madagascar of Indonesia because it's just had such interesting fauna. Those dated to around at least 35,000 years old. Some of these handprints that you get, which are very wonderful to look at, they dated to around 40,000 years ago. And what they make both of these images by, they get an ochre, something like it's hematite probably from ironstone, crush it up, mix it with water and other things. And to do the handprints, they may have it in their mouth and spray it from their mouth onto their hands. So you have a reverse image of your hand on the wall. And it was almost like leaving these prints as their signature on the place where they lived. But what is probably even more lovely about this is for a long time, there's been this quite hubristic view that Europe was the center of artistic creativity, that there was a creative explosion in Europe when modern humans came out of Africa into Europe. And the reason people had wondered that is because if you look at places like the Chauvet Caves in the Ardèche, you see 30,000-year-old, these gorgeous 30,000-year-old charcoal drawings of horses, which are breathtaking. And the oldest art that's known about is 41,000 years old in El Castillo in Spain. And that made people think, well, we haven't found stuff anywhere else. Maybe this is where it happened in Europe. This shows that down in Asia, at the same time, art was booming. And whether you say these two pioneering groups, these two groups developed their art independently around the same time, or perhaps more likely their common ancestors in Africa had art. And certainly there are some anthropologists out there who say it won't be long before we probably find art dating back maybe 60,000 years ago in Africa made by modern early humans.
So is this completely rewriting our idea of sort of our early history?
I think it knocks down this view that there was something special about Europe. And it's embarrassing to say it because it does feel as if, you know, this was a case of as soon as you find some evidence for something, it just means, you know, the fact that there isn't evidence elsewhere may well come down to the fact that no one's looked properly. And the research was better funded in Europe and so on in the past and so on. So you have that skewing your picture of the world. And this is true for a lot of work around digging up human origins remains and so on. You can read more about that with videos and photos at theguardian.com/science. That's all we have for you this week. A huge thanks to Nobel laureates John O'Keefe, Maybrit and Edvard Moser for being on the show. From me, Ian Sample, and all the science team, thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the simple yet powerful website building platform. As a Guardian podcast listener, it goes without saying that you're a clever clogs. The good news is that building your own professional website with Squarespace is easy. Whether the site you need is for a small business, online store, professional portfolio, or blog, getting started takes seconds. Go to squarespace.com today and show support for this podcast and get 10% off. Use the offer code GUARDIAN.